Welcome to The Clever Cookster, your ultimate window into the kitchens of the world's best cooks. I'm Kara Rhoda. We're really lucky to be joined today by Dan Pashman, creator of the Sporkful podcast on WNYC, host of the Cooking Channel web series Good to Know and You're Eating It Wrong, and author of the recent book Eat More Better, How to Make Every Bite More Delicious. Thanks for coming to talk with us today.
Hey, Kara.
Before we get started, I want to say thanks to our sponsor for this week's episode, NatureBox. NatureBox ships great-tasting, better-for-you snacks right to your door. Start snacking smarter with delicious treats like Kung Pao pretzels and jalapeno cashews. Support the Clever Cookster podcast by ordering a free NatureBox sampler box at naturebox.com/QDT. That's right, free NatureBox snacks at naturebox.com/QDT. So, Dan, I'm going to jump right in. I just finished the book.
Okay.
And what I'm going to take away from it is that your philosophy is really that not only what you eat matters, but the way you eat it. Very literally, how you put the food in your mouth is extremely important.
Yes, that's right.
When did you become so passionate about getting people to eat things more correctly?
I've been passionate about it for a long time. I mean, friends of mine who've known me for years, who long ago got tired of listening to me talk about sandwich engineering or bite consistency versus bite variety or any of these things, can't believe that I've turned this into a job, you know? So it's definitely been something that I've been passionate about for a while, though it's funny, you know? So I started the Sporkful podcast, and, like, I thought I had a good idea. Like, okay, I'm going to talk about basic foods in extreme detail, and it'll be kind of funny. But I didn't really realize until after it got going that I was like, actually, I've been preparing all my life for this. Like, you know, and then when I got into the book, and there's so much detail in the book, I mean, it's about 350 pages that of eating. And it's not a cookbook, per se, and it's got some recipes. It's really about eating. And I was like, actually, this is where I was meant to be all
along.
It's
your calling.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to get into some examples of the kinds of advice that you're giving people on how to change the way they eat. So let's start with cheeseburgers. Mm. I feel like cheeseburgers are really very basic food. People sort of know what it is. It's a bun, there's a burger, and there's the cheese on it, and there's whatever else you want on it. But apparently, that's wrong.
Yeah, I mean, wrong is a strong word. I guess it's wrong. It's not as good as it could be.
Okay.
Okay. You know, at some parts of the book, I will say, this is the right way, this is the wrong way. Other parts, I say, you know, it's a matter of taste. Do it however you like it, but just understand the factors at play. Don't do it willy-nilly. With the cheeseburger, this is a concept I talk about in the book called the proximity effect, which is the idea that when you put a bite of any food into your mouth, whatever part of that bite is in closest proximity to your tongue will be accentuated. So with a cheeseburger, like if you have a big, thick cheeseburger and just one slice of cheese on top, you take a bite into that burger, you often don't taste very much cheese. Now, the burger is still the star, but I want a little more cheese. So you put the cheese on the bottom, underneath the burger. And by doing that, you bring the cheese closer to your tongue, and you accentuate cheesy goodness. And that's like a simple thing that anyone can do.
And you can start doing it with all kinds of foods.
Totally.
I especially like there's a diagram in the book about salad forking and the order in which you should put things on your fork when you're eating a salad and why chopped salads are actually not as convenient as they seem to be.
Oh, they're the worst. Are you a fan of chopped salads, Kara?
Not anymore. I read the book.
No, chopped salads, first of all, like in a lot of the sort of chains that feature chopped, if you're at a restaurant where they really pride themselves on a great chopped salad, maybe. But most people who are eating chopped salads are eating them at one of these chains where like the chopped salad is like a way to get rid of like the leftover really crappy, like brown around the edges iceberg lettuce that they like picked off a factory floor somewhere, you know, and then they dump too much dressing on it and it's got too much surface area in relation to the volume in the greens in the chopped salad. And so the greens release all their moisture when they're exposed to the salt of the dressing and the fat, and the whole thing just turns to like gruel. I mean, it's like prison food.
It's sort of like salad tartare. It's not really like it's a different texture.
Totally, totally.
As I was going through the book, one of the most memorable things for me was the goldfish cracker cereal. The idea that you can put some goldfish in a bowl, pour milk on it, and eat it as if you were eating cereal. I tried it.
Okay.
It was weird.
Okay.
Not bad weird.
Right.
Sort of like when you're making mac and cheese and you sort of eat a little bit before it's really hot or done or mixed.
Or like before the powder is totally dissolved.
Yeah, which I like that.
Okay.
But I feel like there's almost less a culinary intention than sort of a psychological innovation here. Like you're turning upside down the way that your brain thinks it should be experiencing the food that you're putting in your body.
Yeah, I'm glad that you had that experience, because I tried it too. I mean, I had the idea in my head, and I was like, well, I got to try this. I don't want to put it in the book and have it be, you know, people throwing up out their windows. And I had the first time I had it, I had the exact same reaction as you. I was like, that's weird. But then I had a few more bites, and I kind of like my brain, I had to wrap my brain around it.
Mm-hmm.
And the book is divided into, it's a tongue-in-cheek textbook to teach people how to eat more deliciously, and each chapter is a school subject like philosophy, psychology, engineering. And that Cheddar Goldfish is in philosophy, where I talk a lot about sort of upending societal conventions about the way we are supposed to eat things. Like, why is this food a breakfast food and that food's a dinner food? Many of these foods are delicious at all different times of day. And I talk about cereals. And this is something that's always bugged me, which is like, why are there no cheesy cereals? Like, cheese and milk is a natural, like, that's not a weird thing, right? And also, like, why are there no savory? I mean, like, milk is often used in savory foods, like dairy and savory. It makes perfect sense. And I like a savory breakfast sometimes. So Why are there only sweet, non-cheesy breakfast cereals? And rather than like call General Mills and have a cereal manufacturer for myself, I was like, why don't I just pour milk on Goldfish and see what happens? And yeah, I do think it's a good exercise. Like, when I did it, at least, I don't know if this happened to you, I almost felt like I could like feel my brain
trying really hard to figure out what was going on.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Which is kind of a fun experience.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it should be fun when you're eating food. Someone asked me a question last week about artichokes. What's the most efficient way to cook and eat an artichoke and get all that artichokey goodness? And there's obviously like a lot of waste product in an artichoke, and how do you get around that? And I didn't know, so I told her that I would ask you.
I got to be honest, I don't have a good answer for that either. Artichokes, yeah, like I've tried to buy and cook artichokes a couple times, and I'm pretty sure I didn't do it right. Some foods just require a lot of work. Artichokes are the kind of thing that, like, I'm pretty much going to only eat them when someone else is going to make them for me.
That's fine. Everyone should have a list of those,
right,
I think.
Right, right. Sort of, you know, it's like, I talk in the book about stone crabs and like peanuts, like foods that require a lot of work to like open them up to get to the part you want to eat. Crabs especially, I don't know if you're a fan. I'm like, you know, in Maryland, the crabs, it's a big thing. But it's like, it's a lot of work to get only a little bit of meat. It's expensive for the amount of actual meat you're getting. Like, they put it on the table, you're like, whoa, look at this giant pile of crabs. But then you eat them, and then, like, your hands are bleeding. You're tired, you're annoyed, and you're not full. And then the bill comes, and you're like, what?
I like crab cakes. I feel like that's a good way to get around.
I'm with you on
the crab experience.
Yeah, yeah.
So people get pretty intense about their food beliefs, which I'm sure you've noticed as you've been spouting all these controversial ideas everywhere. What's the most confrontational it's ever gotten? What was the argument about, like, how to eat a slice of pizza or a chicken wing that really kind of felt like it might come to blows?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most fun things about doing my podcast and going out and talking about the book with people is, like, I've been doing these book talks at bookstores, and some of the people there, like, are fans of the podcast. They know all about it. But some of the people have never heard of me or never heard of my work, and they're just, like, checking it out. And it's really fun to watch them because they start off, I'm explaining the book and this weird approach to food, and you can tell they're like, they don't quite get it. But then I start doing like explanations, I get in details, I start doing demonstrations. Like, we have an Oreo cookie demonstration that I do with the proximity effect, where you eat it with the frosting side down right on your tongue. And after 20 minutes, they're like nodding in agreement, and they start raising their hand and they're asking questions. And that's really fun. And one of the things that in these sessions has been really contentious is my definition of a sandwich. That one gets people fired up. You know, I feel like you got to draw the line somewhere. What is a sandwich? What is not a sandwich? And so in the book, I say that I look to the Earl of Sandwich. I look to the framer's original intent. That's why I say I'm the Scalia of sandwiches. Like, I'm a strict constructionist. And I think that you got to think about, like, what was the Earl trying to accomplish when he created the sandwich? Would he recognize this structure as a sandwich? And I think that the two-part test I've laid out is, one, you got to be able to pick it up without your hands touching the fillings. Pick it up and eat it. Now, if a little bit spills out the back, the intent was still there. It's just maybe it's a poorly constructed sandwich. The other test is that the fillings have to be sandwiched between two discrete food items. There has to be sandwiching happening in a sandwich, which some people say is circular logic, but I'm standing by
it. So no open face.
Open face sandwich, not a sandwich.
Okay.
No, that's, I call that a bread sundae.
Mm.
Yeah. Because it's, you can't, that's not a sandwich. If the Earl of Sandwich saw an open face sandwich, Kara, would he say, oh, look, one of my...
He would say it's not finished.
Right.
Where's the other piece of bread?
Right.
Yeah.
Right. But a breadless sandwich, I think, can exist and is a valid form of sandwich.
When materials other than bread are used as the... sandwiching
right
structure
right mm-hmm. I think that's the, like, there's a recipe in the book for a stuffing sandwich that I invented for Thanksgiving leftovers, because like I love Thanksgiving leftovers and I love sandwiches, but I don't like a Thanksgiving leftovers sandwich because mm-hmm. you already have mashed potatoes and stuffing in there. You're gonna put it on bread, it's a lot of starch, and now the bread's just getting in the way of the stuff you're excited to eat. So what I do is take beat some eggs, an egg or two, take two baseball sized balls of stuffing and mix the egg in. And then press them into two patties in a frying pan. Fry them in oil. These two stuffing patties. And press them flat. Flip them till they're golden brown and crispy on both sides. And they'll get hard, firm enough that they can now, those stuffing patties that are golden brown fried deliciousness, act in place of your bread. And you spread a little cranberry sauce if you like, mashed potato, turkey, and you put it in between the two patties. And that's your stuffing sandwich.
Wow. Changes everything.
Yeah.
And how about wraps? Are wraps a sandwich?
No.
I'm so glad to hear that. I hate wraps.
Oh, really? See, I love wraps. I just don't think they're sandwiches.
I don't understand why I would want to eat a tortilla that's cold and not in, you know, not fried in oil.
Well, but I mean, like a burrito, the tortilla is not fried in oil.
But it's warm.
Warm, right. I agree that warm wraps...
the temperature
wraps,
of the tortilla right. makes a wrap.
I agree that warm wraps are better than cold wraps. But I there's something about the tooth sinkability of just biting through a wrap. I love all foods in flour tortillas or whatever the ethnic cultural variation. I love Peking duck and mushu pork. I love dumplings and gyoza. I love blintzes. Anything that's like wrapped, anything that's sort of encased in dough, I always love those.
Maybe
foods.
I should be thinking of a wrap as a giant dumpling and I would like it better.
There you go.
That would help.
There you go.
So brainstorm some more Thanksgiving things because I have another Thanksgiving question for you.
Okay.
But before that, I want to take a minute to say thanks again to this episode's sponsor, NatureBox. If you're starting to feel that afternoon slump, don't head to the vending machine. Head to naturebox.com for tasty, wholesome snacks. They're all real food made from nuts, seeds, fruit, and other good ingredients. They've got zero artificial flavors, colors, or sweeteners, 0 grams trans fats, and no high fructose corn syrup. So when I need a pick-me-up, I open a bag of sweet blueberry almonds or pear praline crunch. They're so much better for you than the other snack options out there. And now I want to give you a chance to try NatureBox for free with a trial box featuring 5 of their most popular snacks. To start your free trial, go to naturebox.com/QDT. Start snacking smarter and go to naturebox.com/QDT to get a free trial box of delicious snacks. So as we get closer to Thanksgiving, people are maybe dreading some of the table topics that come up when the whole family is together.
Sure.
Politics, money, grandchildren, all that good stuff. So can you suggest some Thanksgiving food controversies that people can fight about instead at the table?
Well, you can fight over what is or is not a sandwich.
It's an important one.
You can fight over white meat versus dark meat.
Do you have a stance on that?
Dark meat's better.
Okay.
But I try not to tell people because right now... You know, like there's still demand out there for white meat. In fact, white meat alone costs more usually. So let's keep this between us.
Right.
But yeah, no, dark meat, it can be cooked to a higher temperature. It's fattier. It's more flavorful.
I think there's a lot of controversy about when you're cooking a turkey. It's kind of impossible to get both right. Like if you're doing the white meat just perfectly, the dark meat doesn't quite get there. Vice versa. If you're cooking the dark meat, the white meat's dry.
I got a
solution
for you.
Great.
Yeah. This very week, in my episode of The Sporkful, I'm doing 3 straight episodes about Thanksgiving. This week, part of the show is an interview with Kenji Lopez-Alt from Serious Eats of the Food Lab, and he taught me all about spatchcock turkey. Spatchcock is like butterflying. You remove the backbone and lay the turkey out flat. And this results in more even cooking between white meat and dark meat. Because part of the problem with the way that we traditionally cook turkeys is that the white meat, the breast, sits on top. So it's the most exposed part of the turkey. So it's the most liable, it's the more delicate more liable to dry out meat, and then we're leaving it out there naked, you know, for all the oven to just to hit with all of its heat.
It's terrible.
And so you're exacerbating the problem of the dual cooking temperatures of a turkey. When you spatchcock the turkey and lay it flat, the dark meat pieces sort of stand up top higher, and the white meat sits flat and is lower down and therefore is not so exposed to the heat of the oven. That allows you to take the turkey out at a moment where both the white meat and dark meat will be at their ideal temperature.
There you go. Maybe we'll try that this year. For more lessons on how to eat more better, check out Dan's book and also the Sporkful podcast on WNYC. And join us next time on The Clever Cookster for more tips and tricks from the kitchens of the world's best cooks.